That's right. That's right. You know what it is. JT back in the building, flying solo. The anchor is out. The anchor is with the family. Big anchor, big AC, at home with his family. Enjoy it, kid. Enjoy it. Ah, I'm JD Bunkus. And that sound you hear is just, relief. Feels good to be free. Feel like, I don't know, what would you guys say, like 285 pounds lighter. It's a good show on Sports 759 The Fan. I'm JD Bunkus. Man, that was one. That weekend was just so full of stuff that I got basically a checklist I'm going to try to go through here. Highs, lows, sadness, shocking excitement, frustration, you name it. This sports weekend had it all. I'm going to save most of my Leafs thoughts for Leafs Hour today. I got Justin Bourne for an hour. I always like to get to break things down with him, hash it out with him. I don't really want to go game by game so much just because I thought the Leafs weekend was frustrating, and I don't want to make excuses for these guys, but they've been playing a lot of hockey and they're sick. They got a bunch of Marlies down on the fourth line. They got a goaltender that I think is working through something and was really good for two periods, and then they basically just hung him out to dry after tying up the game. But should you really have to have Jack Campbell and Freddie Anderson put together A1 performances, even when you're tired, even when you're sick, to beat the Sens and the Sabres? I don't know. It seemed like we can point to all these excuses that I mentioned, and we can talk about some of these things like the flus and the wear and tear, and it's all fair. It's fair to bring those things up. And yeah, these Leafs looked worse last night than I've seen them look in a really, really long time, so I'm sure there's some merit to it. It's just, it's hard to really push that stuff or forgive that stuff when we've become accustomed to performances like that. You can say it's been better under Keefe, which I think it has been, but this team does still lay eggs. They still have, how many times has, I think Sheldon Keefe said it himself, that it was an embarrassing performance. He said that his team wasn't in the building that night. Other teams play tired too. Other teams have difficult schedules. And I know other teams have games like that. It just seems like the other contenders, like I'm watching Boston. They were playing the Red Wings. It's Saturday afternoon. And they just bludgeon them because the Red Wings stink and the Bruins are good, and they just go in there and they take care of business. And they just say, it doesn't matter. You're the crappy Red Wings. We're going to stomp you out. And that's what we always say on the show, especially, is good teams stomp out bad teams. They take care of business. And then that night, I'm watching the Leafs fight tooth and nail. I'm watching Jack Campbell have to basically stand on his head in the third period as a team that's led in scoring by Connor Brown is hanging tight with a team that's talking about playoffs and Stanley Cup aspirations. So the theme of the season continues, which is just confusion and flip-flopping and extremes. But like I said, I'll do more of it with Borny when we hit 10 o'clock today. I'm going to start positive because the Astros really, really pissed me off. And Rob Manfred really, really pissed me off. And I really can't get over it. And I know I'm going to go into a tear. And I don't think I can come back from that. So I'm just going to start with NBA All-Star Weekend. It was awesome. It started so weird. I went into this thing with a checklist. On Friday, we did our all-star storylines that I was most interested in. And for so many seasons, it's basically become grounds for tampering. And this time it was actually kind of fun because the Raptors got to be the head of the snake for that. Raptors fans got to enjoy what it was like trying to, I don't know, feel as though you were luring a player to your city. I don't think that Giannis Antetokounmpo gives two craps about who he played with at the end of an all-star game, or even that he's thinking beyond this season, but it was just fun to play out that mental exercise of watching Nick Nurse play he and the two Raptors all-stars together in crunch time in what was, yeah, a thrilling all-star game. But the weekend starts pretty much like it always does, which is no one cares about rising stars. It's basically a dunk contest where the rookies and sophomores just basically take turns scoring as many points as they can, all well and good. A celebrity all-star game that had very few celebrities anybody cares about in it. And then a three-point contest where it lacked star power, it lacked the best shooters in the game, or at least a lot of them. And they added this do zone ball, which, man, it didn't really work. a lot of guys kept missing the ball. They kept passing it. It was pretty clear that it gassed out some guys and they didn't have the strategy down, or they didn't even put in the effort to really learn the new course. And so whatever, that ends and you're thinking, man, all right, just get me to the dunk contest. And it starts with Dwight Howard. And Dwight Howard, this is kind of the year of Dwight, where he's flipping the narrative a little bit. He's supposed to be the best version of himself, that LeBron has fixed this guy. And he comes out and he does all the corny Dwight Howard things. He starts off with a corny Dwight Howard dunk and you just think, all right, here we go. Second dunk is Derek Jones Jr., who does the same thing. He sings happy birthday to himself. It takes like 5 minutes. He's getting ruthlessly mocked by the broadcast crew, rightfully so, because it was so cringy. I don't know why guys think props like that are going to go over well. Very, very strange. But he throws down a dunk over somebody and you say, oh, wow, this guy's springy. This is going to be the yearly dunk contest entry where maybe this guy's springy, but does he have any creativity to go along with this thing? Because we know you're going to need it to be facing Aaron Gordon, who obviously wants this thing. You know how the rest played out if you're a sports fan, which is it ends up going to Aaron Gordon and Derek Jones Jr. And the two of them basically have this incredible dunk off. And then Dwayne Wade spins the controversy. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because it's a dunk contest and I get it. It's not the most serious thing in the world of sports. I would just say Aaron Gordon has put together 2 years of the most incredible dunks that I've ever seen. And he has no rings. He has no trophies to put on his mantle. And I think that sucks for him because he clearly wanted it. And I have two solutions for the NBA dunk contest. One, just let Kenny Smith be the judge. He cares about this thing. He's got an eye for this thing. His commentary is excellent. Who wouldn't watch Kenny Smith just like mic'd up, getting chirped at by the rest of the panel as he basically put in all of his judging? It all just came down to him. I don't know if he would want the pressure of that, but I don't really think he would be afraid of it. Think about the things that those guys say on that show. And two is, if you're not even going to do that, at least put some judges in there who are going to care a little bit or maybe not rig it. And the only reason I say it is for this. People are now gambling on that event. And you can say that's stupid. You can say that's a waste of money and people get what they deserve if they bet on something like that. Blah, 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 go on and down the line. But the NBA is putting it out there that they treat it seriously. They treat it as a Hallmark event. It's usually, until this Sunday, the Hallmark of the weekend is the dunk contest. That's what everybody wants to see, right? If I offered you tickets to the NBA All-Star game this weekend or just the dunk contest, you know what you would choose. It's the dunk contest. When it goes well, like it did here in Toronto or when Vince Carter won it, it's awesome. It's a thrilling, thrilling event to be at. I was at the one in 2016 here, and again, it was a very, very unparalleled sports experience in my life. So I just think that the NBA can't really have it both ways here where they say, hey, listen, it's no big deal and Dwayne Wade's screwing around and that's all part of it. And then take it away from a guy who clearly wants it and then say it doesn't really mean anything. It's weird. I think they got to do some fixing there. I don't know what it is. I think that it's better off if they have scoring that isn't just nines and tens. Maybe they do it on cumulative dunks. Because again, really Aaron Gordon had all 50s across the board. So switch something up, but you can't do that again after this year. And Dwayne Wade, so lame that he just keeps going around and telling people that two other judges gave him a nine when it's pretty clear from all accounts that they had this thing scored out so it would be a tie and Dwayne Wade went rogue and now he's playing with people like they're stupid. And I just, be the villain for 5 seconds, Dwayne Wade. It's going to blow over. No one's going to care. Just own it. Duh. Then the All-Star game though. I don't want to speak in hyperbole, but that was one of the most entertaining moments in an NBA season that's seen the Raptors basically exceed expectations by like, I don't know, 9 to 10 wins at this point of the season, especially considering their injuries. You got Kyle Lowry on the floor taking charges against Kawhi Leonard in the fourth quarter. You've got NBA All-Stars bitching and moaning at officials over every call. Like Chris Paul, I know it's Chris Paul, but he was jumping up and down, yelling at officials. And it started in the third quarter, sort of late. And I thought, okay, maybe we're going to see a little bit of this because it really worked out well that they put the charities on the line in the crowd where they were really visible and that they were loud and cheering. I don't care how rich you are. A lot of these guys come from extremely humble beginnings And who doesn't care about winning money for a charity? You got to be a monster. You got to be a monster not to give a crap about kids cheering their lungs out in the end zones for you to win them a couple $100,000. Life-changing money. The Kobe Bryant Award was on the line. Obviously, guys were going a little bit harder in honor of Kobe, making it a little bit more competitive. We'll see if this thing actually has legs, if it lasts. I'm scared that an injury will always change these things. But again, these guys play a lot of basketball games. I don't think that playing a quarter is a little bit hard is that big of a risk. Some people were freaking out about it. I'm not going to be that party pooper. I thought it was incredible. I think the game was amazing. What a success. What an unbelievable success. Fixing an all-star game is crazy. And I said this on Friday. I'm more of a fan of the all-star game than other people. I just have connections through it or with it throughout my life. I've always loved the NBA all-star game. I've always cared about who's on the floor to close it. It's just one of those things, one of those weird sports fan quirks where you get tied into something at a young age through a parent, whatever, where it just means a little bit more. And I was skeptical because I'm not the biggest fan of change when it comes to sports. Like, I truly believe if you want more MLB teams in the playoffs, you're an idiot. I can't wrap my mind around anyone who wants that. Who would look at it and say that change makes sense? And I thought the Elam scoring, which is basically making it so that there's the target score at the end of the game, which they had, was a bold move. I was thinking, how's this thing going to play out? What if one team's well up in front of the other? How is this going to be entertaining down the stretch? And yeah, again, guys are taking charges. Guys are playing defense. Poor team Giannis couldn't get a bucket for the longest time. They had just basically no spacing, and Kawhi Leonard's clamping down and LeBron James is clamping down. You saw what I thought was a pretty good representation of the best players in the NBA all on the floor at the same time, giving a crap in a pickup game. And it was fun. I could not believe how many texts I was getting from people where they were just blown away. And I know that part of that is anytime you exceed expectations, it always feels a little bit better. So like producer Mark Boffo and I were talking about this before the show, like you're expecting the same old crappy all-star game. And so you get that and automatically you're thinking, oh my God, guys are trying. Guys are giving a crap. Amazing. I'm all in on this. But it was more than that. It genuinely was more than that. I know I was emotionally invested. I wanted the Raptors team to win. I was loving Nick Nurse calling timeouts. I was choked when Kyle Lowry was taking some bad shots. I was embarrassed when Pascal Siakam couldn't score on James Harden down on the low block twice in a row in ISO. Ugh. It was fun. It was an awesome, awesome weekend. I think they absolutely keep this format moving forward. I think a lot of people, the players, the NBA, deserve a lot of credit for this. Because who doesn't want to see the All-Star game next year? Who doesn't want to see if this thing continues? And if you're a basketball fan, this would actually make it jump NBA All-Star Saturday, which is also a success. You actually get the whole weekend. So kudos to everybody involved. Now for the bad. Whew. Astros and Rob Manfred, man. I can't believe these guys shoot themselves in the foot this way. That they've had so much time to prepare, so much time to reflect, think, and this is the best they have for everybody. So yesterday, there's a 45-minute interview with ESPN's Carl Ravich. And Manfred sits down with him and he answers basically every question that you want answered. And then he holds a media conference at Braves spring training. And it's essentially just, he was a stand-up comic working a smaller room with the ESPN interview. And then he went to the main stage and worked the exact same material for his special. That's what it was. Nothing was different. So if you missed the ESPN interview or you missed either one of them, it was basically a carbon copy of the two things. So say what you will for Manfred, at least he was consistent with the way that he sold this thing. But the Astros hold their media conference last week, and Jim Crane and Altuve and Bregman, they all trot out there. They're basically unapologetic. Bregman's thing is super lame. Altuve's thing is super lame. Carlos Correa kind of starts to become the face of this thing and then has this massive heel turn and starts calling out other people saying they don't know the facts. He does an interview with Ken Rosenthal where the second question and answer is a lie by Carlos Correa, where he misstates the facts. So I just wanted to go through a couple of these things that really frustrated me the most and why I don't think Manfred has done even a passable job here. He's not getting fired. I can't remember whose Twitter account it was. I think it was maybe the guy from Sports Illustrated, their legal advisor, their legal columnist. McCann. That's right. He had a tweet basically like, this guy's contract runs for a couple of extra years. Revenues are up. He's not going anywhere. He's been a good shield for the owners. Look what he just did for Jim Crane. He absolved him of all responsibility despite being the owner of this franchise. He let him hold a media conference where he just basically would not apologize. We broke the rules. We didn't cheat. We didn't do anything that was to our advantage. So I'm just going to walk you through a couple of things from this Manfred interview on ESPN, which again translated to the media conference, because I think they're basically the most important points to outline. The first thing is this guy is gushing about his investigation team, how they've just done this incredible job, and he can't believe the work they got done. And yet he gave all the players immunity, and 2 seconds later, he's talking about how in a perfect world he would have punished some of the players. How good was your investigative team? You had a player that was within the organization that said there was all this cheating going on. You have guys on the internet that did a better job of investigating this thing than you did. You have guys on the internet that break down the bangs and have published them for everyone to see. And you're talking about transparency like you broke down all the walls. You didn't do anything. All you've done is frustrate fans. All you've done is frustrate your players. No one is satisfied except for the Astros, who basically they've skated clean. You can talk about Jim Crane and his $5 million and blah, 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 blah. These guys have completely gotten away with it. Just look at the way that they're handling themselves. So the gushing about his team just pissed me off right away. I couldn't even take it. Then he starts getting into the reasons why these things happened. Naturally, most people want to know, man, how come you didn't punish the players? How are you not punishing the people when basically your big transparency is that this was player run? And this is the way that he addressed that.
Among the things that the Astros failed at was after the Yankee-Red Sox decision, I put the clubs on notice as to what exactly the rules were and how they were going to be treated going forward. Among the other failures of that organization, that information never made its way to the players.
How is that possible?
Well, so they just didn't do it. I mean, it's in my report. The memorandum went to the general manager, and then nothing was done from the GM down. So we knew if we had disciplined the players, in all likelihood, we were going to have grievances and grievances that we were going to lose on the basis that we never properly informed them of the rules. So given those two things, number one, I knew where, or I'm certain where the responsibility should lay in the first instance. And given the fact that we didn't think we could make discipline stick with the players, we made the decision we made. Having said that, I understand the reaction.
This guy said, I understand. I want to say 50 times throughout this interview. He did the same thing. It's basically the PR move 101 of even when you're getting yelled at by your girlfriend, you do that move. Like, I hear you. I'm listening to you. I get it. But all the damage is really done, right? You're just trying to cover up your tracks. You're trying to move forward. You're trying to seem a little bit sympathetic. You at least need to know that you're listening. And that's what Rob Manfred claims he's doing here. So basically, this guy is saying that when they put that memorandum out for teams to stop cheating, that they couldn't punish the players because the teams didn't tell the players that cheating was wrong. That's the reason. That they just didn't feel like they could fight up against that. Well, you know, they were banging trash cans and using video to break team signs in game. And we just felt like they didn't really know that wasn't allowed. Some guys are saying, I think it was I don't think this one was Cody Bellinger. I think this was Chris Bryant, where he said it's worse than steroids. So some players feel that strongly about it, and yet the Astros can't be held accountable because, hey, no one really told them the rules. If I just, like, start swearing all over the radio about the Astros right now, I just want my bosses to know that I cannot be held accountable because you did not remind me that I'm not allowed to do that today. Let's move on to clip two.
It's important to think about the deterrence aspect of this discipline. You had four pretty accomplished baseball people, managers, GMs, that not only were suspended for a substantial period of time, but lost their jobs. I hope that that's enough to make people at those levels understand the responsibility they have and make sure that they're playing by the rules. The idea that Jim Crane was not disciplined here, I kind of disagree with that. I mean, he suffered. He owns an organization. That organization was fined $5 million. Whether you think $5 million is a lot or not, it is the maximum amount allowed by the Major League Constitution. Gave up four draft picks, and people can minimize the effect of it. But if you talk to any good general manager, there's tens of millions of dollars of value involved in those first and second round picks. And then, of course, there's the last piece that's most important. The public airing of what went on here is a form of discipline and maybe the most powerful deterrent of anything that we did.
This is just unbelievable. Hey, you guys did the punishing. We put it on you, the public. Keeps talking about transparency. There's all these limited facts. I don't have time to go over the buzzer answer he had, but essentially, Major League Baseball and Rob Manfred have kicked the can onto you, sports fans, to determine what this means and what kind of impact this has. And in doing so, and this guy keeps saying it's this big deterrent and blah, 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 blah. Again, Carlos Correa tried to lie to Ken Rosenthal in his second answer about the impact of this. He tried to say that they didn't cheat in 2018, that they played clean in 2018. They're telling everybody that they played clean in 2019. They're essentially saying, you know what? We did some things that were wrong in 2017, but we actually should still be judged on what we do this season because we're a really good baseball team. So all that stuff is kind of irrelevant. All the feelings everyone has about us, we're actually lashing out at those people now. We're actually lashing out at the Cody Bellingers of the world. We're lashing out at reporters like Jose Altuve showing up today at his media availability, showing off his tattoo and taking off his shirt. They're lashing out like Jim Crane talking about how it didn't give them advantage. These guys have no remorse. They don't care. They're thrilled that they won a championship and they do not care about how they did it. There's no remorse. They're pissed they got caught. They don't give a crap about anything else. Rob Manfred acting like these guys are moping around like they actually have some shame is false. It doesn't meet up with what we're actually watching. And this is why this is so unbelievably brutal, that this guy didn't have the stones to go to the wall and suspend the players that were responsible for this. To make sure that, one, you felt like there was some type of justice being done. Two, that there would actually be some precedent for teams to not do this in the future. And three, so that you don't basically have mutiny from your players, your former players, and your fans when it comes to your treatment of this. And he keeps going on about, we did such a good job, we did transparency, and, you know, this is the true punishment of this thing. This guy doesn't get it. He doesn't get it. He's trying to cover his tracks. He completely blew it. He botched it, and no one is sorry for it, and now everybody else has to pay the price. And now all of the punishment is supposed to be on you and I with our Twitter accounts and for the baseball players who have to take to the microphone and basically say they're going to drag the Astros for 5 minutes. And that's it. That's the punishment for the Astros. Your tweets and a couple of quotes from Cody Bellinger and Chris Bryant and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. What a commissioner. What a job. I'm going to talk about this more with Dan Shulman and maybe calm down again. I can't believe this continues to make me this mad. It's a good show. I'm J.D. Bunkus on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Now, back to Good Show with Ennis and Bunkus on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
It's a good show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm J.D. Bunkus. No Benny today. He's enjoying his family. It is family day after all. And Dan Shulman is good enough to interrupt his family day to join me now. What's going on, man?
You're living the dream flying solo today, huh?
I just went like 25 minutes alone. I think that's probably too much. I think that might be a bit too much me.
Like without a guest? You just talked for 25 minutes?
I had 2 minute long clips from Rob Manfred. So the only person that no one wants to hear from more than me, it's like that's all the reprieve I gave the listener. But yeah, I had things to say off the weekend. It was busy. It was busy. And basically I started it with, you know, there were highs, there were lows, there was sadness, there was excitement, there was frustration. It was kind of an all-encompassing sports weekend.
You're right.
And I wanted to have you on today because I kind of felt like we could touch a lot of the bases together. Do you want to start with something fun and move from there? How do you want to do this? It's up to you.
You're the host.
Okay.
You get it started.
I know I'm the host, but you're Dan Shulman, so it's kind of rank has gone out the window here.
That doesn't do me any good any other aspect of my life. Like if I walk into the bank and there's a big line and I go, you know, I'm Dan Shulman, like it doesn't do me any good. So I appreciate you saying that. But why don't we start with Tony Fernandez? I mean, that's a big one, right? I mean, that's a sad one for people of a certain vintage, and I'm of that vintage. This is a hard one. You know, he was one of the greatest players the franchise has ever seen. He played here 4 different times. He holds all kinds of records, level of excellence. And we'll try to put it into words. Like, there were other players who were, for lack of a better term, better than him. You know, a few players the Jays have had who may have done more. But there was just something about him where buddies are texting me and I'm texting them about, remember that sidearm flip? Like, there was just something about him that made him stand out. Some of it's quantifiable, some of it's like more intangible, but he was a guy that, back in the 80s, especially that first stint, everybody just loved him. He was as good a shortstop as there was in the game back then. This was a hard one. You know, the last we had seen, it appeared he had maybe stabilized and maybe was improving, and obviously it wasn't meant to be.
Yeah. So, for someone like me who wasn't around for Tony Fernandez, for me, it's basically going off of listening to what other people say and then small amounts of different highlights. Is there a way that you would try to describe him as a player to someone, again, who really wasn't around for any of his prime?
I'll try, and cut me off if I get too long here. So first of all, when he came up in 83 or 84, I think he came up more in 84, like he was about the skinniest major leaguer you've ever seen in your life. And he's 6'2", 6'3", but he couldn't have weighed more than 165 pounds. And he had a way of holding the bat in the batter's box, switch hitter. It almost looked like the bat was going to slip out of his hands. Like, he was holding it so loosely, like limp-wristed almost. And so back then, I'm like 16, 17 years old, and you're playing ball with your friends, and we would all imitate his batting stance. Didn't matter if you were a right-handed batter or a left-handed batter, because he was a switch hitter. We would all imitate his stance, like a slight crouch, and the bat looks like it's going to fall out of his hands, and then all of a sudden, like a whip, just bang through the strike zone. And he had line drives all over the place. He ran well. I wouldn't say he was a graceful runner, but he ran well. But really, as much as he did have good offensive seasons, you know, triples and steals and so forth, it was his defense. I'd never seen anybody play shortstop like that before. I had seen Ozzie Smith and Gary Templeton and Cal Ripken and some of the other great guys. But Tony, and I'm sure you've talked about this with other people, he'd go in the hole, like, so he'd range far to his right, over towards the third baseline. He'd go in the hole, backhand the ball, transfer it to his bare hand, and he would sidearm flip it, like just a little snap of the wrist, and the ball would seemingly be in the air forever, and it always got there just before the runner did. It was accurate, and it wasn't a rocket. Tony didn't set his feet, come over the top, and throw a missile like some infielders do. It was a flip. That's the only word I can think to describe it, and it always got there. And he could also go up the middle to his left and throw across his body remarkably well. He was just a very agile, different kind of athlete. And his personality, not to jump ahead too much, like sometimes he was happy, sometimes he seemed sad or brooding almost, but he was a kind, gentle man. You know, in the 80s, when he came up, I was in high school. When he was great, I was in university. When he came back in 93, I was doing Jays Talk on The Fan. And when he came back again in 98, I think it was, and was a hard-hitting third baseman, I was the Blue Jay broadcaster on TSN. So, like, I saw him at all different parts of his career and all different parts of my life, and he was a kind soul. He really was, and he was a special player. He was a really, really good player.
I think that a lot of times the players that resonate the most with us are the ones that we imitate when we're younger. Like, they say that, you know, music, when you listen to music when you're 15, 16, that's the music that shapes you. That's the music you listen to for the rest of your life. And I think that's the same way with athletes where, you know, when we're all doing this stuff, when we're all starting to pretend, whether it's home playing street hockey or in your driveway shooting a basketball and pretending like the shot clock is running out, or like you just said, where you're playing baseball with your friends, like, those are the ones I think that impact you. So, to have a player like that who, would have shaped the way that kids are holding a baseball bat. I think like those are the kind of legacies that last. Like, that's the stuff that just, I think, like, stands above all else.
Yeah, and the flip was something too. Like, again, the offense was something, but if you know, defense is what really stood out about him. And I was a left-handed first baseman, so I couldn't imitate anything that he did. But, like, every kid you knew, other than me, I would be the kid catching the flips at first base. Every kid would go in the hole and try to do it, what Tony did. There also seemed to be, because he was quiet, because he was thoughtful, because he was spiritual, like, he was different than George Bell and Lloyd Mosby and some of the other guys on the team. And they were all wonderful in their own way. That was a very exciting time for Blue Jay fans. You know, an expansion team in 77, not a good team until 83, and then good from 83 right through 93. When those teams got good in the mid-80s, when they got Bell, when Barfield came up, when Mosby came up, when Upshaw drove in 100 runs, when Dave Steeb arrived, when Tony Fernandez arrived, it was unbelievably exciting because they had been so bad in their expansion years, and now they were up there competing with the Yankees and the Red Sox. And Tony Fernandez was a big part of that. And he would hit in all different parts of the order again. But there almost seemed to be something vulnerable about him. Like, he was more accessible to us. He wasn't like, you know, the bombastic George Bell or the gregarious Lloyd Mosby. He was a quiet, thoughtful, and again, as I said, sometimes almost appeared to be sad sometimes. Yet other times he had the biggest smile in the world on his face. And I think he just seemed a little more, you know, like a little closer to us. We could relate to him a little better, and we wondered about him. And he was just very different on many levels. And he was a really special player. He really was.
I think that's all really well said. And it's hard to pivot out of stuff like this, but I got to ask you about the Astros stuff that happened over the weekend, because it's just such a big story. The way that Rob Manfred has handled this. I don't know if you saw the interview with Carl Ravich, or if you just saw the media conference down in Atlanta, or how you ingested some of this stuff, but do you have a feel as to, or an opinion on how Rob Manfred has handled this so far, not only in the punishment, but now with the PR fallout?
Well, let me go back to the Astros press conference, which I know is a little bit older, and I'm sure you and Ben talked about this last week. I don't think that could have been handled much worse than it was. And I've been around the Astros a lot through ESPN, and especially in the playoffs, ESPN Radio, the last 3 years, because they've been great, obviously. So I've seen them a lot in October. And there's just a general, and you'd think it would have gone away by now, there's a general, we didn't do anything wrong, we're bulletproof, we know what we're doing, and there's an arrogance about the organization, and it was handled poorly. Bregman and Altuve shouldn't have come out for 15 seconds each and then left. And Jim Crane showed no accountability, totally absolved the players of all wrongdoing, said they got rid of the two guys they needed to get rid of, and let's move on. And that's not the way to handle it. And when you've done what these guys have done, you got to take some punches here, and they're not very good at doing that. In terms of Rob Manfred, I'm a little on the fence on this, and I'm not sure this is what you're going to want to hear. Like, and I remember talking to Scotty Mack a few weeks ago on air, and he was like, take away the championship, vacate the championship. And it didn't feel right to me, and it still kind of doesn't, although I don't have much of a reason for saying that. The only reason I would say is, like, what if we come out in 2 weeks and we find out that the Red Sox did XYZ in 2018, and it wasn't quite as bad as what the Astros did, but it was still bad. You know, it's a slippery slope when you start taking away championships and that sort of thing. In terms of immunity for the players, I don't like it. But I don't think he had a way of getting the information without giving immunity. Like, he's not a district attorney. He's not police. And I think there's only so much they can do. And I think he was afraid of getting into a war with the Players Association. I think what they wanted to do was find out as much of the truth as they could. And they felt the way to do it was to grant immunity to the players. I would love to see it different. I just don't know, JD, how they actually would have done that. I don't think they had the power to do that. I think they're afraid of lawsuits. I think they're afraid of work stoppages. I think they're afraid of battles with the Players Association. And ultimately, I think baseball and the Players Association, they're going to have to sit down at the table and get on the same page about this stuff, like they eventually finally did about steroids. I don't think baseball can do everything it wants to alone. So I don't know if that answers your question. I wish it could have been harsher in certain ways. I wish the players could have been punished in certain ways, but I think baseball said, ultimately, our end game here is to find out what happened and prevent it from happening again, and I'm not sure they could have done that without conceding in the areas that they did.
I think you're bang on in that it is complicated. Whenever people do bring up the stripping them of the championship, it's like, okay, yeah, there is fallout from that. And you're right. It's pretty obvious that if they want, like, they granted these guys immunity. However, I don't know. I'm torn on that because, again, I don't know exactly what their investigations revealed. But when you have Mike Fears, who's publicly stating that this has happened, and then you have guys who can break down videos of them banging drums, and you have inside shots of their clubhouse where you can see the setup that they had, It seems like there was enough evidence for them to just not automatically grant immunity. And I think Manfred's strategy of just like, well, if we put it all out there, that's the greatest punishment of all, hasn't really worked, because this is what I take exception to. One is that Manfred yesterday referred to stripping them of a title as like taking back a little piece of metal. Like, you're right. The commissioner of baseball. You can't just be referring to World Series titles as a little piece of metal. But secondarily, he keeps saying that the real punishment is that these guys have to live with this and these guys have to bear it with it. And it's just like, everything we hear from baseball players and everything we hear from, you know, we talked to David Sampson on Friday, is that their world is so insular that they can be protected from things. And you just look at the way that Jim Crane has already sheltered them and their responsibilities when it comes to what they've had to do with the media, or the way that Carlos Correa has handled himself in the fallout of this, which is basically lashing out at other people and throwing expletives at Cody Bellinger. And it's like, these guys don't have remorse. The one thing that you're supposed to say they have is something like they're hanging their heads and feeling bad about this thing. And yet there's no contrition. There's no public, there's nothing. It's just, basically these guys skated completely free. And Manfred continues to tell us that the punishment that they really wanted to put out there is an effective one. And it's not matching what the eye is telling us.
Right. So a couple of things. I think Manfred is going to say that what they've done is the most effective thing they could have done, even if it wasn't the most effective thing they could have done. Right. Yeah. He did say there were certain areas, you know, we didn't feel we could do this, so we only did that.
And a perfect
in terms
world,
of them
yeah.
skating. I'll disagree a little bit on that. And I am amazed. Like, Carlos Correa is a very intelligent guy, and at the beginning, he was one of the first guys in the clubhouse on the day of the Jim Crane presser where he actually said some really good things. And then when Bellinger came out firing, Correa fired back. And I couldn't believe this part. Went like at bat through at bat of the World Series in 17. Well, there was a runner at second then, so we couldn't have been doing anything. And that's unnecessary. And again, I think it's just part of it is the arrogance of the culture of the Houston Astros, which apparently has not been shattered. It's been dented, but it hasn't been shattered. But I don't think these guys are totally skating. And I'm not saying the commissioner or anybody else should hang their hats on, hey, they're getting hurt in the court of public opinion. But every columnist in America has destroyed these guys. And every road ballpark they go to this year is going to destroy these guys. It's going to be, I don't think we've ever, in my lifetime, I can't think of anything. Well, I guess like Bonds, you know, when Barry Bonds was Barry Bonds and everybody thought he was on steroids and he's approaching Hank Aaron, a lot of people were just, you know, out and out rooting against him. But this is going to be a whole team. And I don't think it matters if Jose Altuve, you know, had the banging of the drum 3% of the time and Carlos Correa had it 99% of the time. Nobody cares. Nobody's going to distinguish between that. And I think these guys are going to have a really hard year. So I would dispute a little bit that they've just skated, but I would have liked to have seen more. And by more, like, are we talking about player suspensions? Like, if Correa got 40 games and Altuve got 15 games and on and on and on down the line, would that have satisfied everybody? I don't know. I don't know what would have satisfied everybody other than maybe taking down the banner. And you know, as you know, my winter world is college basketball. Mm-hmm. And championships have been vacated. Banners have come down. I'm going to Louisville Wednesday. There's a banner that's not there for a game they played in and won when they won a championship. Jim Boeheim, in the Syracuse game notes, it says here's how many wins he has, and it's not how many wins he has, because 105 of them were taken away for recruiting violations. Michigan, like the same kind of thing. Like, I've seen banners come down, and it's something that stays with people a long time. But I don't think that Rob Manfred felt they could do that without maybe it opening up other cans of worms that weren't worth fighting for. And you know, baseball's got to wear some of this as well, because as we know now, teams went to baseball before Mike Fiers came out with this stuff. Like, teams went to baseball last year, 2 years ago, and said, hey, the Astros are doing this, and baseball never really opened up an investigation on it. So although you'll never hear baseball say it, I think baseball's got to own some of the responsibility for how far this got as well.
Hey, Dan, thanks for the insight today, man, and appreciate you sharing memories of Tony Fernandez with us.
All right. You got it, JD. See you later.
Dan Shulman, Blue Jays voice, ESPN, all those things. Yeah, I think they should have vacated it. They had to do it. These guys now, if they win a World Series this year, it's like nothing ever happened. They get to point to it. They're a talented team. They're a really good team. They could absolutely win this year. Even if they put up a good record, they're going to be able to say, we're amazing. See, they don't need to win. They just need to make the playoffs. And that sucks. When we come back, lead in the Leafs Hour with just a thought on the goalies. On Good Show, on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
This is Good Show with Ennison Bunkus on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Good show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm JD Bunkus, flying solo today. Benny's back tomorrow. Happy family day to everybody. Thank you for spending some time with me right now. If you're listening on the podcast, subscribe, leave a review, share it with friends. If you're not, you're listening to this live, I hope the feed is okay. By the way, the Astros, they're meeting with the media right now, and like Carlos Correa is saying, he's done talking about it. It's moving on to the regular season, and the other Astros are getting hit by their local media with hard-hitting questions such as, do you think you guys will be able to get back to having fun again? Bregman answered, yes, I do. Wow. So glad Manfred nailed these guys with the punishment of having to live with it for the rest of their lives. Or maybe like 5 minutes before Carlos Correa decided, no more questions on this. And Astros beat reporters moved on to, are you guys having fun? Is it fun time yet? That's a lot of not fun time, wouldn't you say? I'm going to save the Leafs goalie stuff for the Leafs Hour. I'll just say this. One of the Leafs goalies has finished top 10 in Vezina voting twice in the last two seasons and also has a Jennings trophy to his name. One of them was the backup to John Quick, who did not become an NHL regular until his age 27 season just 2 years ago. There's no goaltending controversy. We're going to talk about it next on Good Show's Leaf Hour, presented by Drive Auto Group on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Now, back to Good Show with Ennison Bunkus on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Good Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm JD Bunkus. No, it wasn't. There's been lots of good content today on Tony Fernandez, and I would recommend people go and listen to it from other shows. I know Blair will have obviously a lot lined up. Who's Blair with today? Do we know? Is it Brunt? Oh, it's Medani and Deitch today. Well, I know Arash will have lots of good stuff. The morning show was great. Scotty Mack. They had Cito Gaston on today, so go check that out if you want to hear any of that. Who else they have? They had Cecil Fielder, right? Yeah, that's cool. So, yeah, they were loaded up. They had a lot of really great content. And, yeah, I haven't spent a lot of time talking about Tony Fernandez today because I didn't watch him. I just think it's not very genuine of me to discuss somebody who I didn't watch or who I didn't know at all. So yeah, I asked Dan Shulman, and I've asked some other people in the know, and I'll do a little bit more of that now. Let's welcome in our show's friend, J.P. Arancibia, former J. Oh, he's not there. Never mind. Let's welcome in me, more of me talking, not J.P. Arancibia, me. Yeah, let's absolutely do that. So I started the show, and I wanted to play three clips from Rob Manfred, but somehow, some way, my long-winded self found a way to talk so much that I couldn't even get to the third clip before we had to take a break. Just an incredible feat of narcissism and inability to be concise. I played two clips from Manfred. One of them was about what he believes the real punishment is, which is like these guys taking it upon themselves. Whatever. How the media is supposed to hold them accountable, how fans are supposed to hold them accountable. He talked about how no one's ever going to look at 2017 and say, oh, well, that's unblemished, except for they totally will. And that what's just so unbelievably unfair about the idea that they're going to do that. One is you've got the commissioner of baseball talking about a World Series ring as a piece of metal, which was like, that was quite a thing. It's like, oh, we didn't really feel like we should strip the title because, like, what's the point? It's just a piece of metal. The thing that we're all playing for and that everybody, every fan base is dying for and every player basically dreams of winning, but it's just a piece of metal, so whatever. And we really feel like the punishment is that fans are going to be tweeting about it and some media members are going to ask some questions. Again, today, these guys talked in front of media, and Carlos Correa, who has been Mr. Open Book, Mr. I'm going with an apology 1 second, then crapping on players in the next one, then trying to cover for Jose Altuve with just like extremely stupid and unthoughtful excuses, trying to put the blame on other people, trying to like shoot shots at other people, trying to lie about 2018 to Ken Rosenthal. Again, this guy's trying to control his narrative, saying that the Astros didn't cheat in 2018 when they have proof they did. Then you've got your commissioner saying, oh, actually, we believe them about 2019 because they said so and they admitted to the other cheating. It's like, you can't tell the difference between what a buzzer and stealing signs would be. You can't see how that would damage a player's reputation like Jose Altuve forever. It would immediately remove him from Hall of Fame discussion. It's just painful, man. It's just painful. So anyways, I wanted to talk to somebody who actually knows these things and who actually can tell you how damaging stealing a sign can be and having this information could be, and who is one of these guys' peers and has to kind of watch this stuff from afar. It's J.P. Arancibia, former Jays catcher. What's up, man?
Not much. I'm kind of dumbfounded the same way I think that you are, what you just alluded to.
Yeah, okay. Where do you want to start with this thing? Because I get it. Manfred was in a really difficult position, and he's talking about wanting to have transparency on this thing. But he just held two different media availabilities, one with ESPN, one with the public, and he had a month to prepare for these things, and he's still kind of stumbling over himself and talking about what the actual punishment is. But how can it be effective, like he claims it is, when every fan of the game is still pissed, and there are players out there and former players who are talking about, like, I think Chris Bryant said this is worse than steroids. And he's saying that everyone's satisfied. It's like, how can people be satisfied when your fan base and players are pissed off?
Well, I think even if you just watched yesterday's his like address, I thought he looked very uncomfortable in general. Just his like presence and the way he was trying to make jokes throughout the press conference and trying to be funny. I think that was like a huge sign of how uncomfortable he is. I think that he knows that he's full of crap right now and what he's doing, because it's the fans, it's all the current players, it's all the guys that are not playing, it's all the people that are looking up to the major leaguers. Like there's a lot of layers to this, and I think it's a joke the way that that the commissioner has kind of handled it, because they haven't done anything to get the players, because they get immunity because they were open about certain stuff, which, let's be honest, I think that there's a lot more to it than what they're fully coming to, you know, to terms with or what they're opening up about. But I just, it's sad that that's the way it's handled. And then all of a sudden, you know, Dusty Baker's coming out and Manfred talking about, like, we're going to be super tough on guys that hit these players and people that are, and yes, it's dangerous and stuff, but it's like, wait a second. So you're going to protect these guys that cheated and that were, what they did was disgusting. And then all of a sudden you're just like, but no, but please guys, don't be upset at them and let's protect them. And I just think that it's kind of a joke the way it's been handled.
Yeah, man. All of those things are so true. I can't believe that basically they're like, the cheaters are the victims is the way that this thing's getting doled out, right? They're saying Manfred's position has basically been, these guys are already dealing with enough because they have to live with it, whatever that means. And again, this flies in the face of the way that they're handling it, because Bregman's talked for 5 seconds. He wouldn't talk about it on media day. Then he talks about it for the little speech that he gives. Then his owner protects these guys, basically says they didn't have an advantage. And then they meet in the dressing room today, in the locker room today, and they basically just say, we're not talking about this anymore. We're moving forward. And a reporter actually asked them right after that, asked Correa or Bregman, when do you guys think you're going to have fun again? It's just like, I can't believe this thing. Like, it's unbelievable. And then their priority is to say, hey, we're going to protect the players. We're going to make sure that these guys are protected. And when you talked about that snickering thing about Manfred, I don't care. I get it. I'm someone, when I used to get in trouble in high school, and I think it even happens to me now, is when I do something dumb and I'm being confronted with something, I can crack a smile. And I don't mean to be that way. It can be a nervous twitch. But I watched him in his interview with Carl Ravich, and Ravich asks him about, he reads him a quote from Hank Aaron, who says, I think whoever did that should be out of baseball the rest of their lives. And they pan to Manfred, and as he's reading this, he's smirking. Like, he's smirking. I'm like, how could you be so unbelievably just, I don't even have a word for it. You just so out of touch with this and not give a crap after one of the greatest players in your game tells you how offended he is by it. And you're just simply like, no, we figured it out. We actually have a better handle of this thing. Like, it just, I don't know how other players are going to be able to look at Manfred now and just move on from this.
Well, I mean, I don't think that they're going to move on from it. I think that he loses respect daily. And listen, I don't agree with the statement of you should be banned from baseball forever. I mean, I think that's
neither do I.
Insane. I think that's crazy. But at the end of the day, there's something that has to be done, because if stuff is not done, let's be honest, we all know, and I don't want to, I hate that it's going to happen. It's going to be handled in other hands. Other guys are going to take the onus of doing something about it, because people are upset. Current players are upset. And now, because of them handling it the way they handled it and give these guys immunity, then guys are like, all right, forget it. Then we'll get after it. Then we'll make sure that they know, because really at the end of the day, other than, and I thought it was funny of him going like, oh, just look at their faces. Go fly a kite. What do you mean go look at their faces and look how distraught they are? They're not distraught. These guys, when the doors close, they're fist pumping and going like, dude, we just got away with pretty much whatever we wanted to do. And yeah, we have to save face in front of camera, but these guys are not like just in such dire straits that they just feel so terrible. And then I'm sure it's really tough to wake up. No, these guys got a World Series ring. They got a check that's bigger than the guys that lost. They got a big share of the check. They're doing just fine with it. So I think that was a joke too, when he's like, oh, you know, look at their faces. That's BS.
Dude, this has been one of the biggest problems I've had with the entire thing, is that the commissioner keeps telling us that these guys are hurting. And I'm like, where? Where's the proof of that? So some guys have basically gone completely underground and you can't hear from them at all. Like, no offense, but Justin Verlander and McCann have been two of the quote unquote like protectors of the game. These are two guys that, you know, McCann's going to meet with somebody at home plate and tell somebody how they should have celebrated. And Justin Verlander loves to speak out about certain things when it's convenient to him. And then when it actually gets hit with him, he's kind of pretty silent. And both those guys just like nowhere to be heard from now, like nowhere to be heard from, whatever. Carlos Correa looks like he's contrite and then starts blasting other players and then lies about how involved they were in 2018, like openly to Ken Rosenthal, just tells them like, yeah, we think we played clean in 2018, whatever. And they're spinning this narrative now of, well, you know what? we didn't do things the right way. We don't feel great about it, but judge us based on what we do moving forward. So now there's this idea that if the Astros are good, and of course they're good, man, like no one thinks that these guys are just baseball. They wouldn't be in the major leagues if they couldn't cheat. There's obviously all-stars littered throughout this ball club that if they're good this year, if they make the playoffs this year, that now it's going to invalidate anyone who thought they were a cheater in 2017. Like, you're right. They've completely skated from it. And I look at it and say the only way that this is now going to be handled from a legacy standpoint is if a decade down the line, people are looking at Hall of Fame stuff. Like it feels so brutal. Everyone feels so lost in this thing. And I can't believe that we're here today the way that this is.
Well, here's my opinion too. And I think this is the reason why I think Manfred is trying to downplay it and trying to just, hey, let's squash this and move on. Is because I believe that they were not the only team that was going to be doing that. Now maybe abruptly as they were doing it, banging on trash cans and stuff like that. But I don't believe truly that they're the only teams that would have done anything like that. And that especially with the technology, and you have the live feed going throughout the clubhouses, and you have the video guy there. I just think that if the case was, because he said he wasn't commenting on anybody else other than Houston and Boston during that press conference, I think that baseball would be in a different position if they did an investigation on every single team. Not that every single team would be guilty, but I truly believe in my heart more than one team would be guilty.
Yeah, and clearly there's still an ongoing investigation with the Red Sox, and we'll see what this ends up revealing. And I get it, right? You end up punishing these guys more, and it starts this slippery slope of going back in time and having to judge a bunch of these other teams and these other players, and what do you strip away and what do you do? I get it. It's hard, but that's the thing about their job, is that it's supposed to be hard and that they're supposed to be able to have a steady hand in these positions. And I get that there's probably other cheating around the game, and that you're, like you said, not everyone was doing it. But it's also hard for me to believe that guys like Bellinger and guys like Chris Bryant would be taking the stances that they've taken that are so incredibly hard line, and that these guys would be risking something coming out about them. Like, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they're just being incredibly cocky, but is your sense, like from talking to guys, that most players believe this was something that's just way different than what has ever gone on within their own clubhouses?
I've had conversations that there's more teams than just one that have done it. As far as that's what they've heard, right? This is all hearsay. Yeah. I'm not in the clubhouses anymore. That's what I've heard. I also do. Now though, I'm so skeptical in the way things are how players come about it, because you're talking about Verlander, who speaks at the side of his mouth on one thing, and all of a sudden is mum on the other. I mean, you've also seen guys point fingers and say that they've never done stuff. You've seen, you know, guys like even Ryan Braun that had a press conference on how it was this it was a tainted thing, and then all of a sudden he was tested positive, and then he admits to it. So that's why for me, man, it's jaded. Unless you're in it, I just don't truly buy everything. Now again, could they be accurate and telling the truth? I don't take anything away from them. You have to believe it at face value, but also, have we not been jaded as fans? Because I'm a fan now, and you get jaded to, like, wait a second, this guy that was 130 pounds tested positive for steroids, and then he comes out and admits it, and you're like, this guy would have never done it, I thought. And then guys that say, hey, I promise, I never did anything, and all of a sudden it comes out on a Netflix documentary and all these different things, like the screwball and all that stuff, that these guys are doing stuff. Like, I second guess everything now.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point, that you still need to be skeptical, and that especially when the heat is on another group like this, that, yeah, maybe there aren't as many eyes on you, and so you do get to be a little bit more immune when it comes to firing and dragging people. So, no, I think you're absolutely right to be skeptical. Last one on this I want to ask you is just, what do you make of the way that the Astros have handled themselves in this? Like, the players, not, like, it's pretty clear the Jim Crane element of this. There's been guys that have been fired, and they've discussed their own, they've kind of spun their own narratives on this thing, but Carlos Correa specifically, the way that he's spoken about it, Jose Altuve and Alex Bregman, they've kind of been the faces of it. What have you made about the way they've handled it?
I think it's weak sauce, man. I think it's the way that if you go and you do that, you man up, you have the full conversation, you answer questions, you say what you need to say. But I think that, you know, they're just kind of playing it off. Again, there's nothing. They didn't get really. They got their hands slapped. Oh, I had a conversation. And I opened up about certain things, but they. So then that's why I think that. Why would they have the emotional conversation and sit down and talk in front of people if they're like, hey, man, all that can do is make it worse? So I think it's a joke the way that they've handled it. And I think, you know, Correa calling out Bellinger, you know, I'm not upset about the way he went over the certain things at the in games where they were playing on the road and they, you know, they came back. And, like, I can understand him trying to argue back and forth, but, like, dude, if you're going to be that passionate about defending yourself, about winning the championship, be that passionate about coming out and sitting down in front of people and go, hey, dude, ask any of you guys, ask me questions, and I'll answer you to the full of my abilities, or, you know, whatever, how truthful I want to be. But I think they've been able to duck out, and I think it's part of its leadership when you have your owner come out and say the stupid crap that he said, that it didn't affect the game. Like, dude, I would have rather that guy not say anything and just – did even worse, I thought.
Yeah, I love he just comes out in the T-shirt. He's like, didn't affect games. Okay, thanks, Jim Crane. Like, really appreciated you weighing in here. And, yeah, it allowed those guys definitely to have a veil over them when it comes to the criticism. And, you know, we've talked about this already, but the idea that these guys, that there's all this transparency, I don't feel as though it's all been transparent. I don't feel as though it's all been laid out exactly what's happened here. Like, we never even got answers on buzzers. Manfred's reason for the buzzers not being a thing is that the guys didn't lie about it. And it seems pretty clear that they all want to protect Jose Altuve, like, to an incredible degree. And that obviously they would be willing to admit the stuff that people can prove and not be willing to admit something that happened a year later. Like, it just, this stuff is so wild to me. And we have precedent for this, right? Like, we've seen this with players before when it comes to the steroid era. Like, you own it up. You do the Andy Pettit thing where you just say, hey, listen, we did this. We screwed up. We want to move on from it. But, like, watch us play this year. That's it. We're just going to eat it. We're going to eat it. We screwed up. We lost. Like, it sucks. They don't strip your title anyways. You go out this year, you rake, you play well, and eventually people are going to be like, turns out maybe that wasn't such a big scandal anyways. The way they've handled it has just made it so much worse. It's dragged it out so much longer. And now I don't think anyone's ever going to give them the benefit of the doubt because of it.
No, and with the buzzer thing, like, listen, I don't know for sure, but you can't tell me if I had a walk-off home run that I'm going to tell people to keep my jersey on. I'm going to be saying, keep my jersey on, run into the clubhouse, and come back out. Like, I'm Talladega Nights full on running around like I'm on fire after I hit a walk-off, not thinking about it. And then that's the way he handled it. And again, you know, when you assume, obviously assuming is not the best thing. But I think that it's a pretty strong assumption to go, something wasn't right there. It smells fishy, it's fishy.
Well, especially since none of these guys can keep their story straight about what the reason why he didn't want to do it. It's like, well, one is that it was his wife didn't want him, even though there's like a billion pictures of this guy shirtless. Two is that he had a tattoo, and then now there's video or there's photographic evidence that, like, he didn't have the tattoo. Then it's like, it turns out he shows up today without a shirt on and he does have the tattoo, but it's a tattoo of his daughter's name in writing. It's like, oh yeah, he was really going to get raked over the coals for that. Like, wow, a tattoo of your daughter's name. So embarrassing. You just hit a walk-off on Aroldis Chapman. You took a 100-mile-per-hour pitch over the fence. Like, now everyone's going to focus on that. Like, it just, you're right. Something's fishy about it, and it's hard not to draw the conclusion that people thought that they had buzzers. There was reports from other teams that they thought that they had it. You look at the way that Chapman reacted in the moment to it. You look at the way that their team reacted to it without ripping his shirt off. How he ran into the dugout, how he does change. It's just, yeah, I'm sorry, but you guys are cheaters. You don't get the benefit of the doubt. And that's just the way that it is. We got to run, but I got to ask you about Tony Fernandez. You tweeted about him. I'm sorry for your loss, man. Again, obviously a guy that you knew. Do you have anything that you want to share about Tony?
Honestly, he was just the guy was a godly man. He was the most kind spirit, and everything that I ever was around him, he would speak to us as players. And then at these events, you know, the alumni events, you get to be around him. And I don't know if there is a person who was more of a genuine, gentleman. And
we lost JP there. That's too bad. But I appreciate him coming on today. It was really good stuff. And, if you want to hear more about the life of Tony Fernandez, we had lots of stuff today. Dan Shulman, Cito Gaston from leadoff, Cecil Fielder on leadoff, and there's going to be plenty of more guests throughout the day who are going to speak to his life and his legacy. When we come back, it's my buddy, Vivek Jacob, on Good Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Let's go!
This is Good Show, Good Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Coming up, I was confused. My mommy kissing the girl. Confusion occurs coming up in the cold world. Daddy ain't around, probably out committing felonies. My favorite rapper used to sing, check, check out my melody. I want to live good, so shit, good I sell show. Dope for
a Sports F5, not of the fan. I'm J.D. Bunkus. Benny's back tomorrow after he does his family day hang. Timberlake gets his Fatone back.
I shouldn't have spent so much time off the top talking about the dunk contest. I wish I could have a redo on that one. It was fun, and it was amazing dunks, and it was weird. But really, the story of the weekend was, for the first time in a really long-ass time, the actual game. The actual game was amazing. This is what NBA All-Star Weekend is usually about. People tricking their employers into sending them down to these games so they can basically go to parties, which is cool. No hate. But that's what it is. It's an awesome party weekend. We had it here in Toronto. It's incredible. There's tons of celebrities in town. You get invited to different events. It's amazing. It's an awesome, awesome experience. So that's basically All-Star function step one is party for media and celebrities alike. The fan stuff is secondary almost. Second is that it's NBA All-Star Saturday, which everybody loves. They ruined one of my favorite things ever, which is the three-point contest. They just put guys in there I didn't care about, and they add the dew ball and whatever. That the guys didn't even prepare for it. They're like missing the dew ball. They're walking back, blah, 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 blah. Dunk contest is amazing, but same thing, problem always happens, which is people don't know if it's supposed to be a serious event or if it's just supposed to be for fun. You have weird things like Dwayne Wade obviously cheating and rigging it on an event that people are gambling on and supposed to spend time on. And then for whatever reason, he won't just admit it. He's doing this whole thing where he's not the only one to give Aaron Gordon nines. But Aaron Gordon actually, I think he's more memorable because of this. I don't know. Now that he's been cheated twice. But then ultimately, man, Sunday. I'm like half watching the first couple quarters because who cares? And there's a Leafs game on. And then I dial in the third. And all of a sudden guys are like starting to care. And Kyle Lowry's playing hard. And I just love Kyle Lowry so much. Just thinking this is the perfect guy to fix the All-Star game is the guy who cares and who's actually going to try to run an offense. And they're intentionally fouling and they're trying to get off buzzer beaters to tie it up. And then we got this fourth quarter that I think is an all-time event. And I know this is recency bias and blah, 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 but that fourth quarter was and is going to be one of the highlights of the NBA season. Fact. That's a fact. Let's bring in my buddy Vivek Jacob to talk about it a little further. What's up, buddy? How you doing?
Not bad. Like I said, looking back on the weekend.
Yeah.
And you hit the nail on the head, man. That fourth quarter was incredible. I'm kind of curious to know how long that fourth quarter actually went. Obviously, we're used to it being 12 minutes, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was longer.
It felt like it was too short.
Yeah, it was gripping right from the start. And I think, you know, the first half, like you said, it just sort of meandered and maybe they had a thing where it's like, okay, you guys win one quarter, we'll take the other. And that way we sort of split the charity money. And then the third, we start going at it. And yeah, that was incredible. I mean, Giannis taking on the challenge of defending LeBron, that block that he had on him, then blocking AD on the next possession. And like you said, who better than Kyle Lowry to be as competitive as can be in a quarter like that.
I'm not even trying to overstate this, but is Kyle Lowry taking a charge on Kawhi Leonard in the All-Star game going to be one of the top five things you remember from this NBA season?
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, he could have had the hat trick of all charges.
I know.
He takes one on the leading scorer, James Harden. He takes one on Finals MVP Kawhi, and then he should have had one on LeBron too.
I know. It was amazing. I loved it so much. My thought on that too, I couldn't express it into a tweet, but essentially that if you had to say there's one thing Kyle Lowry does better than any player in the NBA, it's take charges, right? And for him to get to display that on All-Star Weekend was so beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like there was something so beautiful about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then just the overall defense, the running the offense late in the fourth. And, you know, we talk about, oh, you know, should Trae Young be in the game and this and that? Well, we saw how Nick Nurse felt about it. Didn't start Trae Young to start the third quarter. Had Kyle Lowry closing out the game because, let's face it, that's how you win games, is someone like him. And Giannis, for all the trash that people talked about him being a terrible GM, guess what? He said he wanted a bunch of guys that could compete. And that's why you have a one-point game in the end. He had a bunch of guys that can defend, that can compete, and left it all out there.
He did lose, though. he did lose.
He did. On a free throw.
So does that automatically happen immediately? Is that it doesn't? So two things that you're curious about moving forward. One is, do you think that this ends up happening again in that way, where you actually see guys complaining to officials, digging in on defense that way, fouling pretty hard, actually finding it as a struggle for guys to get clean looks when everyone was dialing in? It basically looked like a playoff game for some moments of that thing. So one, do you think that actually lasts, that has longevity? And two is, do you think that they just make that obvious tweak where you can't have a free throw to end it?
One, I do think they make the tweak. If it comes down to a final possession, you make a playground style sort of dead at 11, whatever it is, and then you just check ball every time there's a foul, and you keep going. Obviously, you might go on for a while with that, but I think that's the best way to do it. You don't want to see it end on a free throw. But in terms of the longevity of it, I am curious because, let's face it, a few years ago when they made it, it was sort of, you know, this Team Giannis, Team LeBron thing where you have captains selecting the teams, that was done to increase the competitiveness. And so that year was really competitive. It came down to the wire. Both teams were defending in the fourth. But then the next year we saw a drop-off. And so how much of this is, you know, trying to honor Kobe Bryant's memory and be as competitive as possible? You know, you got to factor that in as well. So I'm curious to see just how competitive it'll be next year. And then, you know, at the end of the day, I think if you can have someone like Giannis lead the way, I think that is a way to do it, because let's face it, he's as competitive as they come, and right from the get-go, he's been like, exactly. And so, and again, I go back to the way he took on the challenge of defending LeBron, the way even Siakam was defending Kawhi. There are two or three times where Kawhi tried to go at him and then just had to pass the ball off because he couldn't get by him.
Yeah.
And so I think those type of things are what it comes down to. And, you know, let's face it, for all the pride that Giannis and Siakam and Embiid showed in that fourth, I would love to see a Team USA versus Team World game and ramp it up even further. Like, at this point, you've got enough. You've got enough on the Team World side where you'd have a really good game.
You would, because of Giannis. It's like Giannis is kind of your ace in the hole on that one. You're right. And they had they switched Doncic on two different teams, it would have been a lot closer for that. And you know what? I'd be okay with it. Maybe that ramps it up. I don't know if it does. It doesn't seem to work at all in the Rising Stars game. And it always feels pretty thin for the one group. My only problem with that is that it makes it harder for us to get the right representation of who should be there every year, right? Because now all of a sudden you need to force in a couple of guys from Team World that maybe shouldn't be there. And we already have controversies when it comes to guys getting clipped and who should actually be there versus who shouldn't. I think it still makes it easier if you're from Team World. The thing I'm most curious about in terms of they're going to do this moving forward is I loved that they had the kids for the charities they were playing for. I thought it was great. I thought those kids loved it. They obviously looked like they were having a blast. It clearly added an element to the competition, but some people were kind of looking at it like, as we always do in this day and age, which is looking at the negative, which is, oh, it's unfair to the kids or blah, blah, blah. I think that every single person that was involved in that is happy. If you did exit polls, I'm guessing that all those kids were thrilled. I'm pretty sure they all get some money donated to their charities anyways. But do you think that they continue with that moving forward? Did you have any problem with it, or did you love it as much as I did?
No, I didn't have any problem with it. And frankly, I won't be surprised if those kids, the charities that technically lost those quarters, ended up getting money anyway.
Of course.
So, and then just the experience for the kids too. I mean, let's face it, when the All-Star game came to Toronto, there were a bunch of people that wanted to be there that couldn't be there. And so for them to have a chance to experience that game and to be there amongst the stars, I think that's a memory that they'll cherish for a lifetime. And so I think the positive far outweighs the negative when it comes to those charities and the kids that were involved.
Yeah, I loved it. I think it was a smashing success for the entire weekend.
My only nitpick with the system, the way that it was, because I love the quarters, especially once it was the third quarter and they really amped up playing for the charity, is that it did make it a little harder for me to really feel like there was actually an MVP. Like, I know Kawhi hit all those shots and he made all those threes early when it was basically no one caring about the games. And when the game tilted, he didn't really have that much of an impact. I'm like, right. I almost feel like the MVP should only be made off of that final frame.
Yeah, I think that's fair, because even towards the end, you know, I thought if Giannis could have made a couple buckets in the fourth, it would have been him because of what he was doing defensively. But I think when you look at overall, what do those first two quarters mean in terms of impacting the game? You know, I think you're right. I think you're right.
Yeah, just I remember going into the fourth quarter thinking, well, who's MVP? And then it looked like LeBron was going to push for a little bit. Because, again, clearly guys wanted that Kobe Award, man. Like, guys wanted to win that thing. And I could not believe that I'm watching this game and thinking about it like it was a real basketball game. I had emotional equity in the Team Raptors Giannis group actually winning. Like, I wanted them to get it. Like, I was really hoping Lowry was going to make shots. And I was having this internal monologue of, man, Nurse should probably take out Pascal for some shooting here. It's an all-star game. I'm like, you probably should put Brandon Ingram in here. It's like, if we're going to be putting in like, if there's any whipping boy, it might actually be Nurse for sticking with his own guy. But I did love it.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, that fourth quarter when you want the Raptors guys to win, and especially for Kyle Lowry now to be 0-6 at his all-star games, you're thinking, especially the one that's as competitive as this one was, it would be sweet for that to be the one that he wins. So from that standpoint, it was disappointing, but I'm right with you, man. I was cheering for Team Giannis the whole way through, and yeah, it is disappointing that they didn't come out with the W.
Yeah, I can't believe how I felt about it, though. Like, seriously, catching myself in this moment where I'm like, come on, guys, you can do this. Like, drop some good play. I'm like, it's an all-star game. Relax. Like, just make sure Kyle Lowry doesn't get hurt. That's what you should care about.
I think the last time I felt that passionate about an all-star game was probably MJ's last one, where I just wanted him to win it. And then I remember being so mad after he hit. Well, there was the one where he hit the fadeaway over Sean Marion, I think. And everyone felt like he had won it. And then Kobe draws the three shots on a foul on Jermaine O'Neal, and then the game goes to overtime, and then the West win it. That was probably the last time I was like, man, I really want the East to win so Jordan can finish off that way.
Yeah. See, I was a Jordan hater, so I didn't care. I was actually happy. He blew the dunk. I was happy. I was still choked at the time when they wanted Vince Carter to not be an all-star starter. I was like, why? He won the vote. It's fair. It's only fair. Let Vince do his thing. Who cares about Michael Jordan? Now I'm a little bit more sentimental. Hey, buddy, this was really fun today. Thanks for jumping on and doing it.
Thanks for having me.
It's Vivek Jacob, a good buddy of mine. Does a great job. You can follow him on Twitter at Vivek Jacob. When we come back, it's Odds and Ends on Good Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Good Show with Ennis'n Bunkus on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Your imagination's having puppies. It could be a video for new recruits. Just stare into the camera and pretend that you're
Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Last block. So it's Odds and Ends. I actually kind of wish Ennis was here today, because I was so pissed about the Manfred stuff yesterday. I don't mean to be overpopulating your Twitter feeds if you follow me on Twitter with the Manfred stuff. I know it looks like just like a hobby horse, but it actually pisses me off, because I love baseball. And yeah, I've heard the case of, yeah, now the Astros are more hateable. Now you're going to want to watch these games more. No, you're not, because guess what? You're not going to get to see the Astros get beaned, and they're going to be awesome. They're going to be the Astros. You're going to think, oh, this is going to be great. And then the Astros are going to tattoo the Jays 11-3, and you're going to say, oh, it stinks. You're not going to get to see anybody bean someone. And you know what? I hate beaning. I think it's abhorrent behavior. I think that you break it out for real circumstances once in a blue moon, but it's so dangerous. Like, the cost-benefit of it is just off to me.
especially for minor things like when they say someone's showing up a pitcher because he's done a bat flip. Like, all that stuff is stupid. But if there was any team that should have to wear one in the rib cage every once in a while, it's the Astros team, especially the way they've handled themselves, which is so unremorseful. And yeah, I think I said it in the last block, but the last thing from Manfred that I wanted to play today was this clip on him saying, it lends credence, and this is me loosely quoting him, but this is really basically what he said, that it lends credence to the fact that they weren't wearing buzzers in 2019 or cheating in 2019 because they were open about cheating in 2017 and 2018. So it's like, why would they lie about 2019? You're right, Rob. Why would they lie about a completely different offense that would forever taint Jose Altuve's career, clearly the most beloved guy in that locker room, in that clubhouse? Why would they do that? Why would they lie about 2019, a buzzer, which is clearly an unbelievably over-the-top way of cheating that we've never even heard of before? It doesn't lend any credibility to him not wearing the wire. It also doesn't lend any credibility to it that this guy and Carlos Correa can't get their story straight when it comes to why he wouldn't take the shirt off. In fact, to me, if there was some type of a, hey, you get to guess what actually happened here, and if you guess wrong, you're bankrupt. You guess right, you get, I don't know, a prize. Get some money. You lay it on the line. You double your wealth. I'm obviously picking something was up there. Something was amiss. And that, yeah, if I had to bet, I'd bet that there was a buzzer. I would bet there was a buzzer. You look at Altuve's face, you look at Chapman, you want to guess which ones were the teams that were bitching about who cheated and who had buzzers. And the fact that Manfred was already aware that teams were complaining about that, and he keeps going, well, where's the proof? Proof was in the guy taking the 100-mile-per-hour pitcher over the fence. That's kind of what you needed to see. Anyways, some other odds and ends to clean up. John Gibbons is back. Gibby! He's back with the Braves. He's reunited with Alex Anthopoulos. What's his position? Do we know? He's just a bench coach? Scout. Oh, that's less good. I was kind of hoping we'd see him on that team. Either way, I'm really hoping to win my bet with Ben Ennis that someday John Gibbons will be a manager in Major League Baseball again. I still think it's going to happen. Give it time. He's going to get one more crack with somebody. This is the road to redemption for him. 29,000 people. 29,000 showed up for an XFL game in Seattle. XFL has been a hit. This is actually happening. AFL, not the Arena Football League, whatever the other one was, Allegiance of American Alliance Football, the one that was a huge failure where the owner sunk in billions of dollars into it or whatever, and he didn't get any cost. He didn't get anything in return. That one sucked. That was poorly done. But it's just pretty clear there's a hunger for more football outside of the NFL season. And especially now with gambling, that it's becoming more and more prevalent that you can just hop on your phone and you can bet on an app and you can walk into a convenience store and the stigma around it is gone and you can just watch some football and throw a little sprinkle down over a weekend. That seems pretty appealing. And I don't think the NFL's worried at all of this league. In fact, it's probably a good thing for it because it works as a feeder system. They're not going head-to-head with one another. If you're good in the XFL, they'll be able to find you and bring you into the NFL, blah, 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 so forth and so on down the line. But I wonder if they're going to kind of look at some of the stuff the XFL is doing and say, hey, maybe we should actually think about applying some of these rules because it's the perfect, perfect test ground for them. But yeah, 29,000 people. It was rowdy. It's a rowdy crowd. I was impressed. I was really, really impressed that Seattle loves football like that. What else? Oh, I saw this, and I don't understand, but I'm going to close on it anyways. I was led to believe Shea Weber was done for the season, and that was say two. 4 to 6 weeks, I believe, was the diagnosis for Shea Weber. And now I'm seeing on my Twitter timeline that Shea Weber may be back as early as Tuesday. How? How is that possible? Like, one of two things is happening here. Either he was completely misdiagnosed, which, I don't know, seems possible, but also is very, very strange to miss by that much. Or they're asking him to push an injury for a team that, last I checked, was 7 points out of the playoffs, and Habs aren't making it. I don't. You can put that on freezing cold takes, whatever you want to do. The Habs aren't making the playoffs this year, not going down. So why would Shea Weber not shut it down and recuperate? Here's the thing. Hockey Central is on after this show. They have Anthony Stewart. They have Justin Bourne. Those guys will probably be able to answer this question a little bit better than I am. But yeah, this seems a little strange, no? Like, Hall of Fame defenseman out for the season, now all of a sudden back on Tuesday? That's tomorrow. That's tomorrow for those of you scoring at home. Friends, that's tomorrow. Very, very weird. Extremely, extremely, extremely weird. I don't know what to make of it. I'm very curious to see what ends up happening here. Like, what happened with this injury? How did they either get it so wrong? And isn't it a really, really bad look if Shea Weber comes back and he looks hampered and he looks hurt and he gets re-injured, re-aggravates it? So, yeah. True last thing. Evander Kane got suspended. He gets 3 games and he goes on social media to complain about it. And it actually feels like with the Cassian news and the way that Evander Kane has talked about it, the way, who is it in Winnipeg? Little guy, Perreault. The way that he complained about it and he took a stance against the player safety department. The way that fans are upset about it. I'm starting to feel like there's going to be some overhaul during the offseason. Nobody's happy with it. Everyone's confused by it. No one can understand what one precedent has to do with another, or if there is any precedent, or if an injury should be taken into account. It feels like it's all done with no transparency, no accountability, and everybody looks fed up with it. And I have a really hard time believing that with this kind of a groundswell that we're not going to see some form of a change moving forward. It seems like it's pretty cut and dry. Speaking of change, that's happening tomorrow when Ben Ennis returns. Thank you again for spending your family day with me, and sorry for those of you that had to. We're back tomorrow. It's a good show. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm JD Bunkus. Thanks for listening.